Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and if your mission today is to get a really comprehensive, exhaustive, and just thoroughly insightful understanding of the most complex news of the day, you know, from the economic tectonics of AI to the deep fissures in global diplomacy, you are exactly where you need to be.
And I'm Sam Astor. Our target today is the sheer volume of record-setting data, high-stakes political maneuvering, and the essential human stories all contained within the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, November 20th, 2025.
And we are going to provide you, the listener, with a MECE report that's mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive.
Right, on every key article. And we're not just going to analyze the facts, but the implications and the overarching instability that really define this entire news cycle.
And instability is absolutely the key word. Before we plunge into all the tech and geopolitical chaos, let's just quickly glance at the markets. We finally saw some relief yesterday. It snapped a four-day losing streak that had investors, I think, terrified of a much deeper correction.
That recovery was it was really swift and very targeted. The S&P 500 rose a respectable 0.4%.
Okay.
The NASDAQ in the tech index gained 0.6%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it managed a modest 0.1% increase.
But the lift wasn't broad enthusiasm, was it? It felt more like a reaction to one specific thing.
It was a total knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
It was all about one earnings report that basically reset expectations for the entire AI sector.
And that relief is fragile, though. We have to note the 10-year Treasury yield is still sitting firmly at 4.132%.
Right. The bond market is still pricing in significant future inflation, which is putting this, I mean, almost paralyzing pressure on the Federal Reserve, which we will definitely get into shortly.
Okay, let's start with the seismic event that really defined the market's positive tone. NVIDIA. Expectations were stratospheric?
Stratospheric, and yet they somehow managed to just leap right over them.
They didn't just meet expectations. I mean, they redefined the scale of a successful earnings report. Quarterly sales surged an unbelievable 62% year over year.
62%. Hitting a record $57 billion.
That figure just absolutely blew past the consensus analyst estimates, which were centered around, what, $35 billion for the year earlier quarter?
Not even close.
Mm.
And the profitability, it mirrors that growth. Quarterly net income reached $31.9 billion. That's a 65% bump.
But here's the real insight for anyone tracking this stock, right? It's always the forward guidance that matters most.
Always. And CEO Jensen Huang, he increased the guidance for the current quarter. He estimated sales would reach $65 billion.
And analysts had only predicted $62.1 billion. So that surplus, that's what injected all that optimism back into the market.
It is. And Huang offered this, you know, this highly memorable quote that I think really captures the bullish sentiment around the company right now.
What did he say?
He just confidently proclaimed, "We've entered the virtuous cycle of AI."
A virtuous cycle of AI. What exactly is driving that cycle besides just raw demand?
It's pure infrastructure dominance. You can see it right in their data center segment revenue. It hit a stunning $51.2
billion. $51.2 billion. That is almost the entire revenue of some Fortune 50 companies just in one single segment.
It is. They credited the massive uptake to their latest, most powerful chips, the Blackwell line of GPUs, which Huang described as being in demand that is just, quote, off the charts.
So the virtuous cycle, as he sees it, is that the more powerful the chips, the more advanced the models get.
And the more advanced the models, the greater the demand for even more powerful chips. It just feeds on itself.
That seems like a completely unstoppable flywheel, but then we immediately see where geopolitics just acts as a powerful brake.
Exactly. Even a company this successful is hitting hard limitations, and they're being imposed by Washington.
So what's the friction point?
Well, the Trump administration is holding firm on security concerns, and they've indicated it is not considering allowing NVIDIA to sell a version of the Blackwell chip that's customized for the Chinese market.
Which instantly caps their potential revenue growth.
Instantly. It effectively blocks access to tens of billions of dollars in a market that is, you know, just desperately seeking AI acceleration.
And yet at the same time, the administration is approving massive, sensitive AI deals in a completely different region, the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
That seems a little contradictory to the stated security concerns about sensitive tech transfer.
It really shows the complexity of current U.S. foreign policy. You know, it's balancing security against the need to build alliances and, frankly, fund domestic innovation through international sales.
So what got approved?
The Commerce Department approved the sale of up to 70,000 advanced AI chips. These are the high-end GB300 servers, or an equivalent to Saudi Arabia's Humane and the UAE's G42.
And this is a huge reversal, right? Weren't these sales halted before over security fears?
A dramatic reversal. They were worried about data falling into the wrong hands. And this reversal, it coincided with the U.S.-Saudi Investment Forum.
Right, and that's where we saw the true scale of the Middle Eastern ambition for AI infrastructure.
Absolutely. The announcement about Elon Musk's ex-AI company, NVIDIA, and the Saudi AI company, Humane, they're developing a giant data center in the kingdom. It just underscores this whole trend.
And the scale is monumental. I read that the center is designed to consume 500 megawatts of electricity.
500 megawatts. To put that into context for you, that is a staggering amount of power. It's equivalent to the steady output of a large power station.
So why are all these U.S. companies, Amazon, AMD, NVIDIA, flocking to this region with billions in investment?
It's the perfect nexus of factors you need for these massive AI training centers. They need three things: immense land, cheap and reliably available energy, and massive, massive amounts of capital.
And the sovereign wealth funds of the UAE and Saudi Arabia have all three.
They're eager to finance these developments. They see AI leadership as essential for their long-term economic diversification, you know, away from oil. They have the land, they have the energy, and the U.S. companies have the technology.
It's a competitive race where the Middle East holds these key infrastructural advantages.
It is.
So we have this record-shattering success from NVIDIA, this immense infrastructure build, but you mentioned soothing the jitters. Doesn't the very scale of all this spending just fuel the deeper fear that we are building an unsustainable structure, you know, the notorious AI bubble?
It drives that fear directly. The nervousness is deeply rooted in the question of return on investment. The Bank of America survey was stark.
What did it find?
45% of global fund managers cited an AI stock market bubble as the biggest tail risk currently facing the market.
So the underlying fear is that companies, especially the huge cloud providers, are spending hundreds of billions on NVIDIA chips and building out capacity that they might not be able to monetize.
Not fully or not quickly enough. That's the worry. And this isn't just, you know, some theoretical anxiety either. The deepest pockets and the most successful strategists are actively betting against this trend.
Right. That's what we have to look at, the high-profile bearish moves.
Exactly. SoftBank Group, led by Masayoshi Son, they sold off their huge $5.8 billion stake in NVIDIA.
And they're planning to redirect that capital somewhere else.
To other early-stage AI investments. And Peter Thiel's hedge fund also liquidated its $100 million stake. They clearly see the current chip hardware market as peaking in valuation.
And maybe most significantly, the legendary short seller Michael Burry, the main character of The Big Short. He revealed he has taken massive short positions against the stocks of both NVIDIA and Palantir.
And when Burry moves, the market pays attention. He is betting that this growth is an illusion, that it's built on capital spending rather than guaranteed profits.
So it elevates this philosophical debate. Is AI a new utility that fundamentally boosts productivity, like Huang argues?
Or is it an unsustainable, capital-intensive infrastructure trap, which is what the bears are contending? Burry's short positions, they really emphasize that latter view.
And we can see the immediate financial consequence of this fear in companies that are exposed to that infrastructure debt, namely Oracle.
Oracle is the perfect example of how these investor jitters translate into stock movement. They made huge news back in September by disclosing this enormous $317 billion revenue backlog,
which was mostly tied to that foundational cloud deal with OpenAI. The stock soared.
It soared, but now Oracle has lost all of those gains and more. The stock plunge, it reflects the cold reality that the market is nervous about the massive capital needed for this AI build-out.
So how bad could it get for them?
Well, analysts now project Oracle's adjusted debt could double its current level. It could be soaring toward $300 billion by 2028 just to fulfill those AI contracts.
Wow.
And that immense debt is a massive red flag for investors.
And this debt contagion, it even spread into the highly leveraged cryptocurrency sector.
It connects right back to that theme of instability and reliance. The entire crypto rally we saw earlier this year was significantly amplified by debt.
Traders were using margin and leverage, right? I read sometimes gaining exposure up to 100 times their initial capital.
100 times. This is essentially building a skyscraper on a shifting foundation.
And when prices suddenly dropped, which they did after that surprise tariff announcement from the Trump administration, those leveraged positions just imploded.
Exactly. The tariff surprise was the trigger. Exchanges were compelled to liquidate those positions to cover margin calls, and that led to a record spike in daily liquidations on crypto exchanges in October.
Creating a vicious cycle.
A vicious cycle. Bitcoin, which had peaked over $126,000 in October, lost 29% of its value, dropping all the way down to $89,440.
And the performance of companies that hold crypto on their balance sheets is, it's showing the pain.
The corporate exposure is stark. Strategy, which pioneered the corporate Bitcoin treasury model, has seen its stock tumble 36% over the last month.
And Bitmine Immersion Technologies.
Down 41%. And both of them significantly underperformed Bitcoin itself during that period.
So it proves that for every percentage point of gain, leverage provides on the way up.
It delivers tenfold punishment on the way down.
And we have to acknowledge that the regulatory environment under the Trump administration is allowing more of this risk to enter the U.S. market.
That's a crucial insight. Traditionally, you know, U.S. investors were shielded from some of the most aggressive, risky trading strategies you'd find overseas.
But the current crypto-friendly regulatory environment has changed that?
It has. It's allowed exchanges like Coinbase to offer complex products, specifically perpetual futures, to U.S. investors.
Which means the kind of extreme leverage and rapid liquidation cycles that used to be confined to foreign markets are now fully accessible to domestic capital?
Exactly. And that dramatically raises the systemic risk profile of the entire crypto sector.
Okay, so that discussion of instability in the financial markets serves as a perfect segue into the instability at the core of U.S. monetary policy, the Federal Reserve. We are seeing major gridlock emerging.
We are. It's making the path forward nearly impossible to determine. The Fed minutes from the October meeting were illuminating.
How so?
They revealed a deepening division over whether they should cut interest rates again in December. Now, the public vote last month to cut rates to the 3.75 to 4% range was 10-2.
Right.
But the minutes stated that the committee was characterized by strongly differing views regarding what to do next.
So it wasn't just a simple disagreement between two opposing camps. The internal language showed a real lack of genuine consensus.
Precisely. The report noted that many officials, and this includes key non-voting Fed bank presidents, believed a rate cut wouldn't be justified in December.
And this group actually outnumbered the several officials who thought a reduction could well be appropriate.
Right. So it indicates that the committee is far more fragmented than that 10-2 vote would have suggested, which, you know, that poses a serious problem for the institution's credibility.
And this gridlock, it's compounded by a fundamental failure of information flow tied directly back to the
government shutdown. Yeah, from earlier this fall.
Exactly. That's the critical missing piece of the puzzle. The shutdown postponed the release of essential economic data.
Namely, the October employment and inflation reports. And the October jobs data, which the Fed absolutely needs to judge the economy's temperature, is now delayed until December 16th.
Just days before their key policy meeting.
Just days.
And as the Richmond Fed president, Tom Barkin, said, without compelling data, forging a consensus is incredibly hard. So how is the market reading this data vacuum?
The market is reacting by lowering expectations dramatically. Investors had once priced in a December cut as nearly certain. Now, market implied chances have tumbled to only around 1 in 3.
So the feeling is that without data showing clear softness in the labor market, the divided officials will just default to caution and hold rates steady.
That's the feeling. And this gives Fed Chair Jerome Powell an almost impossible task of stitching together a consensus in the coming weeks. He is he's essentially navigating a policy decision with half of the map missing.
On a separate economic front, we did get a slight bit of context on the impact of tariffs, with the August trade data showing a shrinking deficit.
Yes, the U.S. trade deficit shrank significantly in August to $59.6 billion, which represents a 24% reduction from the previous month.
Imports fell, exports rose a little bit.
Right. Imports fell 5.1%, exports saw a marginal rise. And this data point, it offers clear evidence that President Trump's tariff strategy has succeeded in disrupting traditional trading patterns.
Oh, so.
Well, often by forcing importers to accelerate purchases to onshore goods before anticipated tariff barriers go into effect. It's a dynamic scrambling of global commerce, and you can see the quantifiable effects on the trade balance.
Now let's move into the legal labyrinth in Washington, which provided one of the most astonishing admissions of the day regarding the indictment of former FBI Director James Comey.
This is a major procedural bombshell. It goes right to the integrity of the entire prosecution. The Justice Department, during a hearing yesterday, made the highly unusual concession that a full grand jury never reviewed the final version of the indictment against Comey.
How does that procedural flaw undermine the entire case? We need to clarify this for you, the listener.
This is critical. The indictment charges Comey with lying in a 2020 congressional hearing. During the hearing, Judge Michael Nachmanoff pressed prosecutors about these procedural lapses. He noted there were two versions of the indictment floating around.
And one of those versions included a count the grand jury had specifically declined to indict on.
Exactly. So the prosecution essentially admitted that the paperwork, the final document presented to the judge, did not accurately reflect the specific counts the grand jury had actually approved.
So the paperwork was just fundamentally contaminated. The grand jury, which is the constitutional check on state power, was bypassed on the final critical document.
That's precisely why Comey's defense team immediately argued there is no indictment.
And a retired federal judge interviewed by the Journal called this a fundamental mistake.
Something that experienced prosecutors just never allow to happen. And this mistake, it opens the door for the judge to dismiss the entire case based on procedural failure.
And the defense is certainly connecting this procedural flub to their longstanding claim of political retaliation by the Trump administration.
Oh, that connection is unavoidable. The defense argues that this prosecution, which was pursued after Trump repeatedly demanded payback against Comey, is politically motivated.
They pointed out that Trump personally appointed Lindsey Halligan, his former personal lawyer, as the interim U.S. attorney.
Right after Halligan's predecessor was pushed out for not supporting charges against Comey. The procedural flaw, it lends credibility to the narrative that the case was rushed and lacked the unbiased rigor required by federal law.
So the defense is demanding an extraordinary remedy.
They are, arguing that the justice system itself was destabilized by political interference.
Speaking of high-profile legal matters, President Trump signed the legislation authorizing the release of files related to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, he signed the bill, which mandates Attorney General Pam Bondi to release all unclassified documents related to Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell within 30 days.
And this move was forced in part because the bill bypassed congressional leadership and passed with only one dissenting vote.
Right. And while federal investigators have stated they found no evidence Epstein blackmailed powerful figures, the sheer volume of high-profile correspondence still threatens major reputations.
And we saw the immediate real-world impact of already disclosed correspondence involving Larry Summers.
The fallout was instant and significant. Former Treasury Secretary and Harvard President Larry Summers resigned from the board of OpenAI and took an immediate leave from teaching at Harvard.
And this was directly due to the release of correspondence between him and Epstein. Why was that correspondence so damaging?
Well, the correspondence, while it didn't allege illegal activity, it demonstrated what critics, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, termed monumentally bad judgment.
Summers had previously advised Epstein on charitable donations and accepted gifts from him.
Exactly. And for a high-profile figure advising on sensitive matters like AI governance, that perceived lapse in judgment was deemed unacceptable by both the academic community and the tech industry.
So he needed time away from public commitments to rebuild trust.
He did. It just shows the continuing power of the Epstein scandal to destabilize elite positions.
Let's pivot to domestic political dynamics, starting with a surprisingly calculated meeting between President Trump and the NYC mayor-elect, Zarin Mamdani.
This meeting, scheduled for Friday at the Oval Office, is a study in pragmatic politics. Mamdani is a Democratic socialist,
whom Trump had previously labeled a communist mayor while threatening to cut federal funding to New York City.
And yet the meeting is happening.
What's the calculation for Mamdani here? He's a first-time citywide elected official.
It's a highly calculated move based on necessity. New York is the most expensive city in the U.S., and Mamdani won on a platform focused intensely on affordability and cost of living.
So he reached out to the White House, upholding his campaign pledge.
His pledge to meet with anyone, regardless of political affiliation, if it was, quote, to the benefit of the 8.5 million people who call the city home.
So for him, it's about securing federal funding. For Trump, it's an opportunity to project strength.
Exactly. By hosting high-profile, even antagonistic domestic political figures in the Oval Office.
Meanwhile, the administration is ramping up its attack on states that are attempting to regulate AI.
This is a major battle brewing over federal preemption. President Trump is considering an executive order aimed at creating a federal AI framework and challenging state-level AI regulations that are deemed onerous.
And the plan includes a task force to specifically review these state laws.
Yes, and potentially using the threat of withholding federal funding, specifically through an internet access program, to compel states to comply.
And the core argument from the administration is economic vitality.
Exactly. Trump argues that overregulation by states could significantly undermine the economic boost and job creation offered by AI, which he sees as a cornerstone of his economic strategy. It's a profound conflict.
We see a similar pushback from business groups regarding California's ambitious climate reporting laws, with a federal appeals court blocking one key rule.
Yes, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit delivered a win for business groups by blocking California's SB 261 rule. This law required companies doing business in California to disclose how climate change, risks like extreme weather or water scarcity, could affect their financial prospects.
But the court is allowing the related emissions reporting rule, SB 253, to proceed for now. What's the legal distinction between the two?
The distinction lies in the type of information being compelled. SB 253 requires companies to report their actual greenhouse gas emissions, just raw data, which the court viewed as less burdensome.
Whereas SB 261 required these complex, forward-looking analyses of climate risks.
Right. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce successfully argued that Descada imposed a massive and unconstitutional burden on companies operating nationwide, citing First Amendment concerns over compelled speech.
Finally, we need to touch on the lawsuit that pulls back the curtain on the internal ideological war within the FBI under the current director.
This is the lawsuit filed by former FBI employee David Multinsky against the Bureau and Director Kash Patel. Multinsky, who worked for the FBI for 16 years, was fired while trying to transition into becoming a special agent.
And the reason cited was exercised poor judgment with an inappropriate display of political signage.
Specifically, an LGBTQ pride flag at his Los Angeles workstation.
Multinsky, who is gay, is alleging a direct violation of his First Amendment and equal protection rights.
He claims he was targeted based on his sexuality, and his firing is part of a broader ideological purge. This is all in the context of Director Patel having fired dozens of agents and employees deemed hostile to President Trump or to conservative ideals in his first 9 months.
It really highlights the profound struggle between the Bureau's internal commitment to diversity and the new politically driven direction under Patel.
It does. It shows that the system instability we discussed is alive and well within the walls of U.S. law enforcement.
Let's pivot sharply to global affairs now, starting with Ukraine. The Trump administration is pushing a peace plan that is demanding concessions so massive they threaten to undermine Kyiv's sovereignty.
This 28-point peace blueprint is highly controversial, and its architects are notable. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, and Jared Kushner.
And crucially, the plan was drafted in consultation with Kirill Dmitriev,
a known Kremlin confidant who has deep ties to the Russian elite. This collaboration itself signaled the administration's intention to prioritize a deal, regardless of Kyiv's red lines.
And the demands placed upon Ukraine are, from Kyiv's perspective, just devastating.
They are absolute non-starters for the current Ukrainian government. The blueprint mandates that Ukraine must concede all of the eastern Donbas region to Russia,
including areas currently controlled by Kyiv.
Including those areas. Furthermore, Ukraine must drop all demands for an international peacekeeping force, a security measure Ukraine and European allies see as fundamental.
And they have to agree to abandon the goal of joining NATO for several years.
Which essentially confirms the fear that the Trump administration views its job not as restoring Ukrainian territory, but simply as stopping the fighting, even if it means rewarding Russian aggression.
That is the widespread interpretation in Kyiv and Brussels.
It is. A senior administration official confirmed the goal is simply to achieve a halt to hostilities. But European officials in Kyiv view these demands as featuring heavy elements from the Kremlin's wish list.
Despite this diplomatic pressure for peace, the military reality is one of escalation.
A major strategic shift. Ukraine has acknowledged using U.S.-supplied long-range attack missiles to strike deep into Russian territory, specifically targeting Voronezh.
This is the first time Kyiv has publicly confirmed deploying these systems since President Trump officially lifted restrictions on their use.
It is. It suggests the U.S. is now strategically authorizing strikes deep behind Russian lines, reversing previous vetoes by the Pentagon.
So it's a fundamental two-track approach, pushing for highly unfavorable peace terms on one hand,
while simultaneously increasing military pressure on the ground to degrade Russian capabilities. The human cost, however, remains staggering.
The same day, a massive Russian missile and drone barrage struck the western city of Ternopil.
It did, killing at least 25 people, including 3 children in residential areas, underscoring the relentless nature of the conflict. President Zelensky commented that such brazen attacks prove that pressure on Russia remains insufficient.
Let's move from kinetic warfare to the shadows of cyber conflict with this fascinating, almost spy thriller story about tracking a North Korean state-sponsored hacker.
This involved former FBI agents Eric Kerr and Caleb Marquise, who refused to drop the investigation into the 2021 Maui ransomware attack on a small Kansas hospital. The hacker went by the moniker Hades.
The hospital paid the ransom, which we learned was 2 Bitcoin, about $100,000 at the time. What connected this attack to Pyongyang?
The money trail. The ransom was tracked to an ATM near the Sino-Korean Friendship Bridge, the main crossing into North Korea.
And Hades was identified as being part of Enderial,
a North Korean cyber unit operating under the ultimate control of the military spy agency, the Reconnaissance General Bureau. So this confirms it wasn't just criminal theft, it was a state-sponsored mission.
So how did a retired FBI agent manage to execute a sting operation that federal agencies couldn't pull off?
Well, Kerr, who's now a cybersecurity researcher, used digital forensics to track down the suspect. The sting itself was brilliant in its simplicity. Kerr poses a businessman trying to build a crypto casino.
And he just messaged the suspect.
He messaged him saying, "You look like a blockchain expert. Can you help me build a money laundering system?"
And the response was the confession they needed.
It was instantaneous. The person he believed was Hades offered to build the system and then made a remarkable confession in a text message. He admitted developing ransomware and making over $1 million from it.
Wow. What does this case tell us about the difference between standard cybercrime and state-sponsored cyber espionage today?
It tells us the threat model is changing drastically. North Korea is believed to make as much as $800 million annually from thousands of IT workers globally who assume fake identities to secure legitimate jobs with Western corporations.
So the critical distinction is that hackers aren't just trying to break in from the outside anymore.
The new fear, as one analyst put it, is that these state-sponsored hackers are obtaining legitimate remote jobs, gaining access to back-end systems from the inside. As Kerr noted, the hardest part is getting in, but what happens when somebody is already in?
That forces corporations to rethink their entire security architecture. Now, we must turn to a profoundly difficult topic: accountability and the sheer haunting scale of atrocities committed by the Assad regime in Syria.
Since the collapse of the Assad regime last December, investigators and ordinary citizens have been discovering mass graves across the country. Over 100 sites have been counted so far,
confirming the industrial scale of the killings.
It does. And the discovery in Izra brought the horror into sharp focus. At a former farm used as a military checkpoint, rescue teams discovered 31 bodies, some in advanced stages of decay, layered on top of one another in a corner of the site.
Which confirmed long-held fears that the local regime commander had been systematically dumping remains there over several years.
And we know the regime had a highly systematic method for all of this. Thousands were executed through torture at facilities like the notorious Saydnaya prison.
And military intelligence used that chilling euphemism, "a known place," in official documents to refer to mass grave sites.
They did. And detainees who died or were murdered were given official death certificates, falsely claiming the cause was simply that the detainees' hearts stopped. Bureaucratic cruelty.
The forensic challenge of identifying these victims, given the scale and condition of the remains, it must just be overwhelming.
It is painstaking and emotionally draining work. Specialists like Dr. Mamdou Zoubi are washing commingled bones, attempting to match dental records, saving DNA samples. In some instances, bodies were layered in wells over years. The sheer scale is just overwhelming the available forensic tools.
Let's pivot to 2 other geopolitical power dynamics. First, the arms race in the Middle East. Israel is deeply concerned about a potential F-35 sale to Saudi Arabia.
This is an existential discussion for Israel about its qualitative military edge. For 2 years, Israel has enjoyed uncontested air superiority thanks to its F-35 stealth fighters. Crucially, the Israeli F-35I Edir jets are customized with Israeli-made electronic warfare systems and sensors.
And a potential Trump administration sale of F-35s to Saudi Arabia immediately erodes that advantage.
That's the fear, that advanced Saudi F-35s, operated by a non-allied nation, could potentially spot and target Israeli F-35s, neutralizing Israel's most strategic air asset.
It sounds like the military risk is being weighed against the potential political leverage.
That is precisely the case. This potential sale is being analyzed as a strategic lever to encourage Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel.
And former Israeli officials believe that normalization with Riyadh would be the most significant shift in the regional balance of power in decades.
Outweighing the military risks, it's a high-stakes bet on political stability overriding immediate military dominance.
Meanwhile, Israel is employing an aggressive legal maneuver at the International Criminal Court to challenge the arrest warrant against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Israel filed a request with the ICC to disqualify Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan and throw out the arrest warrant. The core allegation is that Khan may have been influenced by sexual assault allegations he faced at the time he sought the warrant in May of 2024.
So the argument is that the warrant was sought to suppress or divert attention from the serious personal allegations against the prosecutor himself.
That is the thrust of the filing. Israel suggests that Khan's decision to hurriedly submit the warrant applications, which were technically approved last November but only publicly sought in May, was painted by the desire to protect his reputation.
And Khan denies any sexual misconduct.
Of course. But this legal maneuver immediately throws the entire ICC process into geopolitical and personal controversy.
Finally, we observe a dramatic consolidation of power in South Asia, specifically in Pakistan.
We see Pakistan Army Chief Asim Munir, whom President Trump has publicly referred to as his favorite field marshal, consolidating power through new constitutional changes.
The 27th Amendment creates a new position for him, Chief of Defense Forces.
It's a 5-year role that essentially resets his term and crucially grants him lifelong immunity from prosecution.
This sounds like just formalizing the political reality that the army is already the most powerful institution in Pakistan.
It is. As one former Pakistani ambassador noted, it's providing constitutional cover to a reality that already exists. This move, combined with the continued weakening of the Supreme Court, reflects a deepening authoritarianism.
Let's transition now to corporate culture and consumer behavior, starting with a spectacular and frankly embarrassing executive hiring failure at AIG.
This story is highly revealing about the toxicity of unresolved corporate culture issues. AIG pulled the $17 million appointment of John Neal as the insurer's second-in-command just days before he was due to start.
Just days.
Right.
And it was because they discovered that his former employer, Lloyd's of London, had reopened an investigation into an alleged workplace affair.
It's astonishing. It raises immediate fundamental questions about AIG's due diligence. How could an appointment for such a high-profile, heir-apparent position fall apart this late in the process?
And what makes this deeply ironic and damaging is that Neal had previously staked his entire reputation on reforming the notoriously male-oriented heavy-drinking culture at Lloyd's.
After he took over as CEO in 2018, the reopened probe focused on his relationship with Rebecca Clement, the former director of corporate affairs at Lloyd's. For a figure who presented himself as a champion of reform, this allegation is career-ending.
And this is not an isolated incident for AIG, is it?
Not at all. They're still dealing with the fallout from the previous executive who headed that unit, David McElroy, who left for personal reasons last year and was subsequently charged with felony sexual assault. AIG's vetting process clearly remains a significant area of systemic weakness.
Moving to retail, Target is signaling a major investment push, effectively admitting they have failed to keep pace with consumer expectations.
Target's incoming CEO, Michael Fiddelke, is making a necessary, albeit late, move. He plans to invest $5 billion next year, a $1 billion increase, to aggressively upgrade stores, merchandise, and digital capabilities.
And this is a direct response to a painful reality. 12 consecutive quarters of weak or falling sales.
Including a 2.7% drop in comparable sales in the most recent quarter. That sustained weakness suggests consumer frustration is high and shoppers are exercising caution.
I read Fiddelke was quoted trying to connect with consumers, saying, "If you're frustrated with our recent performance, we are too."
He was. Shoppers have complained about stores being messy, items frequently missing from shelves, and just a general lack of excitement in the merchandise. The investment is clearly a strategy to revitalize the brand.
Now, let's discuss the future of travel and connectivity, starting with the NFL's obsession with the return of commercial supersonic flight.
This is a great story about long-term logistical fantasy. NFL executives are quietly monitoring the progress of Boone Supersonic, which recently tested its jet, the XB-1. The company's commercial jet, the Overture, aims to cruise at Mach 1.7 by 2029.
Why does this matter to professional football?
It's all about radical logistical shortening. A supersonic flight could cut the New York to London travel time to under 4 hours.
Which unlocks what NFL executives referred to as their wildest fantasies.
The possibility of placing permanent NFL teams, or even entire divisions in Europe. This mirrors history, you know. Decades ago, reliable transcontinental commercial flights enabled Major League Baseball's expansion from the East Coast to California.
And that vision of rapid Mach 1.7 travel stands in stark contrast to the experience detailed in the Personal Journal entry about a slow transatlantic cruise.
That entry detailed a 14-night cruise from Rome to New York, and it presented a fundamentally different philosophy of movement. The key pros noted were unpacking once, the sampler platter of European ports, and the genius of gradually changing clocks 5 times to arrive with virtually no jet lag.
But the cons were significant.
Very significant. Expensive ancillary packages for drinks and Wi-Fi, unpredictable weather leading to missed ports like La Spezia and the Azores, and the days just blending into a tedious Groundhog Day. It underscores that speed isn't always the goal.
Speaking of connectivity, we're seeing a significant shift in U.S. consumer habits, challenging Apple's long-standing dominance in messaging. The failure of the Blue Bubble default.
This is a perfect example of reliance failure we discussed earlier. WhatsApp, the world's default messaging platform, is rapidly accelerating its U.S. adoption. It recently hit 100 million monthly users, with over half of those users on iPhones.
Why are iPhone users finally breaking out of Apple's iMessage walled garden now?
It comes down to hard functionality limits, where the default system just fails the modern user. iMessage caps group conversations at a maximum of 32 participants.
And WhatsApp allows. What is it?
Up to 1,024 people in a single group. Market researchers note that once a group gets over a certain size, for a sports league, a community association, a large wedding party, it almost always migrates to WhatsApp.
And the features that enhance functionality are driving that migration.
Exactly. The communities feature, which lets administrators organize subgroups and set up announcements-only channels, is a massive advantage. Users are abandoning the Blue Bubble not because of philosophical differences, but because WhatsApp is simply more functional.
Let's wrap up with some fascinating cultural and intellectual footnotes from the day's reporting, starting in Austin, Texas.
There is deep local grief in Austin over the proposed closure of Bitacek Middle School, the real-life location where the cult classic Dazed and Confused was filmed in 1993.
And alumni and locals are protesting, viewing the closure as the loss of a tangible symbol of old Austin.
It's driven by budget deficits and a wave of new development. The irony is that the film, which was all about an earlier generation of youth, is now a symbol of a bygone era that is being swallowed by rapid redevelopment.
Then we have a wonderful human interest story about a man who found purpose late in life by exiting the adversarial system he was trapped in.
That's Marty Bryce, a former litigator who retired after 33 years because his cases involved endless and seemingly pointless fighting, all focused solely on money.
And he traded the courtroom for the classroom.
Finding new satisfaction teaching American government to high school students in Philadelphia. He specifically highlighted how much he appreciates his students' open-mindedness, preferring them over a bunch of lawyers and judges any day.
For classical music aficionados, there was an exciting niche announcement regarding J.S. Bach.
The Bach Archive in Germany attributed 2 new works, specifically 2 chaconnes for pipe organ from around 1705 to Johann Sebastian Bach. This is a monumental discovery. But it also reflects on the historical nature of musical creation.
Meaning many of his creations were never written down and were simply lost to history.
Precisely. The primary role of an organist in that era was to improvise. The fact that we are still discovering his genius 320 years later highlights the ephemeral nature of improvisation and the constant slow-motion process of historical and artistic recovery.
And finally, a quick note on economic mobility research and a provocative piece of art.
Harvard economist Roland Fryer's work on economic mobility is essential. He notes that the U.S. ranks surprisingly low compared to Nordic countries. While human capital is the strongest predictor of mobility for poor children, his research found the second strongest predictor is non-cognitive skills.
So traits like resilience, self-esteem, and conscientiousness.
Exactly. He argues that fostering these essential non-academic traits is the key to truly restoring the American dream.
And speaking of America, we saw the sale of Maurizio Cattelan's audacious sculpture.
That was the sale of his 18-karat gold toilet sculpture titled America, which fetched $12.1 million at Sotheby's. The article used the piece as a potent cultural metaphor for the current American era under Trump, bold, controversial, eye-catching, and ultimately an extremely valuable asset.
What a monumental collection of news. The sheer depth of the day's reporting revealed a world operating at extremes.
It did. Record-shattering technological advancement colliding with deep-seated institutional and geopolitical instability. If we synthesize this day, the overarching theme is the failure of reliance.
The financial world relies on a guaranteed AI boom, which the bears are challenging. The Fed relies on timely, compelling data, which the shutdown denied them.
Corporate governance relies on due diligence, which AIG failed at. And politically, the justice system relies on procedural integrity, which was shattered in the Comey case.
This brings us back to one of the most intriguing technological stories we covered earlier, the new arms race in navigation, which is a literal example of reliance failure.
Absolutely. The military is desperately searching for alternatives to GPS because in contested environments like Ukraine, Russia, and others have become expert at jamming and spoofing those signals.
So GPS, the foundation of modern logistics, commerce, and warfare, is no longer the reliable default.
It's not. So the immediate response is quantum science. The Pentagon is pushing for quantum-based solutions, specifically devices like optically pumped magnetometers.
Which is effectively a non-jammable compass.
Yeah,
exactly. These devices use lasers and rubidium atoms to measure the Earth's magnetic field with extreme precision, providing positioning estimates far superior to existing inertial systems. It provides a crucial, non-reliant backup when the satellite signal is denied.
So the deep dive has shown that in every domain, from the electromagnetic spectrum to the inner workings of the FBI, the ground is shifting, and relying on the traditional, dependable system is no longer a viable strategy.
The lesson of this exhaustive report is the growing existential need for resilient, non-reliant alternatives when the default breaks. This leads us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener.
What crucial system in your own life, whether it's a career path, a financial assumption, or a community resource, is built on a reliable GPS signal that is becoming increasingly unstable?
And what is your non-jammable quantum level alternative that you need to start building today?
A heavy but essential question to carry forward as you integrate the insights from this incredibly dense news day. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Until next time.